A very warm welcome to our Big Ten Cancer Research Consortium Diversity Committee and all our listeners who are joining us for our podcast, Bridging the Gap. My name is Monica Joshi. I'm the professor of medicine in the Division of Hematology Oncology at Penn State Cancer Institute. I'm also the chief scientific officer for Big Ten Cancer Research Consortium. This is our second episode, and we'll be ending the year of 2023 at a high note, as we will have some very interesting discussion with our diversity committee co-chairs, Dr. Omene, as well as Dr. Cole, and we'll be discussing with our special guest, addressing barriers to disparity in clinical trials, having a look at the investigator's perspective. So Dr. Cole and Dr. Omene, please go ahead and introduce yourselves.
So hi, everyone. It's great to be with you again today. This is exciting. Great to be here. I am a breast medical oncologist at Rutgers Cancer Institute of New Jersey, a member of the Big Ten, co-chair of the Big Ten Breast Cancer Clinical Trial Working Group, and a co-chair of the Big Ten Diversity Committee. Once again, happy to be working with you all and looking forward to a great discussion this afternoon.
And I'm Craig Cole from Michigan State University Carmanos Cancer Institute. I've been working with the Big Ten for years and years. I'm on the steering committee of the Big Ten Cancer Consortia and a member of the Multiple Myeloma, a Big Ten working group, as well as co-founder of the diversity group.
Great. So let's introduce all of you and our listeners to our special guest, Dr. Ryan Wen. Dr. Wen is an assistant professor in the Division of Hematology and Oncology at University of Illinois Chicago, where he cares for patients with lung and skin cancer. He's a Wen Scholar as a part of a Robert A. Wen Diversity in Clinical Trials Career Development Award. He's also the Director of Precision Oncology Tumor Board Program. So welcome, Dr. Wen, to our podcast. And we are very excited to have this conversation. Could you tell a little bit about yourself, what excites you in the field of diversity, and some of the research you have been doing? And on that note, I also want to congratulate you on being the Wen Scholar. So we look forward to having the conversation with you.
Well, thank you so much for having me into the Big Ten, for putting together this podcast. I think it's a fantastic effort. My name is Ryan Wen. I'm a medical oncologist over at the University of Illinois at Chicago. I originally grew up in California, but I did part of my training at another Big Ten institution at Indiana, and that's really where I fell in love with cancer research and did my fellowship over at University of Illinois at Chicago. And I would say the reason, a big part of my research focuses on trying to ensure that promote more equitable representation in clinical trials. And for me, it's quite personal because it comes down to, can I interpret the results of studies and recommendations to the patient who's sitting in front of me in the office? And the reason why is, you know, when I was going through my fellowship in University of Illinois, you know, we practice on the west side of Chicago. And typically, I'd say our patient population is about 60% Black or African American and 20% Hispanic. And we also serve quite a number of patients who are immigrants or those who don't speak English as their primary language, and certainly a high number of patients who are Medicaid or underserved as well. And so one challenge is that as you are going through your oncology training, you get a lot of training in looking at different literature and looking at all these big studies that are shaping how cancer is practiced. You spend a lot of time looking at these big trials that lead to these FDA approvals. And so as a fellow and as a trainee, you start to recognize, okay, the FDA approval is this almost like this gold stamp of approval. That should be the bar for what's really changing oncology practice. But something I started to realize is when we were looking at these studies, that the actual patients who are enrolled in those trials almost never reflected the patients that I was seeing in clinic. I'll bring up one example that really kind of sparked some of the research that I did. When I was in breast cancer clinic, we were looking at this newly approved drug called alpelisib that was based on this clinical trial called SOLAR-1. And when we looked at this, when we did a journal club at it, and we looked at the actual patient enrollment, you have to go all the way to the end of the supplementary appendix, all the way to the last table to actually find the patient enrollment. And when you look at who was actually enrolled, I think it was less than 4 Black patients enrolled in that trial. and only one patient was actually in the therapeutic arm, in the biomarker arm that led to the FDA approval. So one Black woman was enrolled in this trial that is now used to justify this treatment for the entire US population. And to me, that just doesn't make a lot of sense. I would see more Black women in one breast cancer clinic at UIC than was enrolled in this supposedly pivotal clinical trial. And so I think there's a lot of challenges when these clinical trials don't adequately represent the patients that you're taking care of. That's what really led me to do some of the research and a lot of the work that I do here at UIC.
I just wanted to commend you for all the work that you're doing. In this short period of time, your career is taken off like a bang. In a short period of time, you've shown just how much effort and commitment you're doing in this very important area. So I want to commend you for that.
Thank you.
I absolutely wholeheartedly agree with you. As a breast medical oncologist, we are giving drugs to these patients based on results, as you say, that don't include Black women who are known to have the highest mortality in this disease. So it's very, very important work that you're doing. I'm very interested when looking over the work that you've been doing in this area. You've mentioned the For Me project. It sounds very, very interesting as a way of trying to mitigate some of this issues. And I wondered if you could give us your viewpoint on this, at least with regards to breast cancer, for instance.
Yeah, of course. So thanks for those kind comments. So based on that Solar One finding that I was talking about, I ended up doing a large kind of analysis of all these trials that led to FDA approvals in breast cancer for the last 10 years, and certainly found a low representation of Black women in these trials compared to the US population. And once that paper was published and I was able to get that research out, I then started thinking, how can we, it's almost easier, I'd say lazy, to say that disparities exist, because I think all of us can do research and say things are worse or things shouldn't be where they are. But what can we actually do to try to combat those disparities and make things more equitable? And so that's what led me to be involved in this grant that's called the For Me Project, which is funded by the American Cancer Society. And what For Me stands for is fostering opportunities for research through messaging and education. And this project is really a fantastic collaboration between myself, the PI is Dr. Kent Hoskin, who's a Big Ten researcher, and then Dr. Vita Henderson over at Fred Hutch and Dr. Leslie Carnahan over here at UIC as well. I mean, we have such a fantastic team where what we're trying to do is really understand the multi-level barriers that contribute to disparities in trials. And so we're trying to understand at the societal level, at the healthcare level, at the provider, and then also at the patient level, what are these different factors? And to do that, what we're doing is both one-on-one interviews as well as focus groups with patients, advocates, as well as providers and clinical trial staff, into what are their perceptions about both facilitators and barriers to clinical trials. And I'll say that that's been a really eye-opening experience for me, because I've had the chance to sit in front of, to actually discuss clinical trial with patients one-on-one, but to hear it from both patients who have never been in a clinical trial and those who have has been an eye-opening experience, because you get to kind of understand, I think, patients, not just as patients, but as people, and understand all the different stresses and all the different thoughts and perceptions that come with them as they're going into that medical office. And so some of the key things that I learned is that we are really doing this project specifically for Black women who've been diagnosed with breast cancer. And I think a recurring theme that's come up in some of these focus groups is just the societal pressure that falls on a lot of their shoulders, where this perception that they're the head of their household, they have to handle everything and put everybody before them. And so a lot of times they don't have the time or the effort that they need to put themselves first and to enroll in these clinical trials. And that is a perception that came up again and again. And then another thing that came up quite a lot is that a lot of folks who never enrolled in a clinical trial, it was because they never even knew that a clinical trial existed. That is actually one of the top things that we learned from this, is that a lot of these women, as they were going through their breast cancer journey, they would sign up on Facebook groups or get to be a part of these advocacy groups and learn that, oh, hey, my friend or this person enrolled on a clinical trial. What is that? Oh, I didn't even know that was an option. And so by the time they learn about a clinical trial, they're no longer in that window where they could still enroll. And so I learned a lot about those perceptions that come into it, and then also those barriers that I think prevent a lot of people from even being asked or even knowing about all their options in the first place. And so ultimately, the goal of this project is to turn all these lessons that we're learning into a multimedia intervention, so like a pilot video. And we've already made one that's been funded with supplemental funding by the Jimmy V Foundation. But ultimately, we'd like to make another one that helps patients kind of navigate that clinical trial decision-making process.
Ryan, can I ask a question regarding your For Me project? By the way, very well done. I think I watched it. And if our listeners are currently listening, please go and watch. We'll attach a link for your For Me project in the webpage. Are you planning to have these videos be presented in a community engagement programs like churches and other things as well? Is that, because I think that's the key here, right? To connect a community to the provider centers. Is that something that you've thought about?
Yeah, I think the dissemination part is certainly the next part that we're thinking about a lot. Ideally, in a perfect world, we'd love to get the video that was funded by the Jimmy V Foundation out onto like ESPN or other national networks if they're able to be generous with providing their time for us on that. Because I agree, I think the fact that a lot of folks don't even know what clinical trials are in the first place makes it a difficult decision by the time a patient gets to their oncology visit. They have to deal with a new cancer diagnosis, deciding on treatment. And now on top of that, within a 2-minute period, I have to think about a clinical trial. So I think getting more education about that out in the community is certainly important. And I think I agree, you know, getting this out to local communities that are community organizations that we have good partnerships is also important. And something that we're going to start looking into is how to try to disseminate this information online a little bit better, because we know that patients are online. We know that patients are looking on Google, they're looking on YouTube, they're researching about their diagnosis. And so my thought with getting to patients is always, can we meet patients where they're at? And if patients are already online, can we engage and get to that space to give them kind of validated information?
No, that's great. I think ESPN seems like a really good place.
Yeah, that would be excellent.
Boats, right?
Yeah, exactly. We're gonna have to badger them a little bit for that one because we have to beat out the corporate sponsors. But I'm hoping our goodwill will get us there.
Oh, I'm gonna let Coral discuss the wonderful paper you were out. So.
No, I think that's excellent, Dr. Nguyen. And I hope ESPN works out for you, because I believe they partner with V Foundation and all the we have as well over here through the V Foundation ESPN, in partnership with ESPN for some outreach work. And so I think that's a good step to at least get that out nationally, because I did see it. I encourage everyone to watch it. It was very, very well done, very natural, very effective, and very compelling and very relatable. And as you say, when you start, you know, having one-on-one conversations with patients and seeing exactly what you're thinking, enlightening your minds directly, then you can see the wheels turning and hopefully making changes there. And why this is very important, is as you've been talking about, is the fact that, you know, breast cancer is the leading cause of cancer death for Black women. And they have the highest mortality rate out of every race, racial, and ethnic group. Out of all of them, they have the highest. And when you compare that to white women, they have up to 41% higher mortality rate, which is just a travesty, right? It's tragic. We do all of this work, and yet we're feeling dismally in this area. And so, you know, one of the ways, as you have alluded to, all of these great drugs coming out and being FDA approved, and yet we have issues in whether these are transferable to effectiveness for Black women. And you have published in this area. So we'd like, if you could, please share your thoughts on clinical breast cancer studies that have led to FDA approvals, especially in the past decade, in the context of disparity that we've been talking about.
Yeah, of course. So, like, as I was saying earlier, you know, as I was going through my training, I always thought of an FDA approval, that's really the gold stamp, that this trial couldn't have gotten any better. This is the best possible science that we could do. Certainly, I think they serve a very important role in terms of regulatory body and ensuring safety and efficacy. But as I was saying, as we were looking through these studies, and really it was that SOLAR-1 study that really inspired this research, we noticed again and again, and this is kind of regardless of which disease type that we're looking at, and there's some published research in other disease types as well, that the patients that we are seeing in clinic in the U.S. population aren't necessarily reflected in these clinical trials. And there's certainly a lot of number of reasons for that. But something that we wanted to do was specifically look at the last 10 years of FDA approvals for new breast cancer drugs. The reason we're looking at that last 10 years is certainly in the last that since 2012, there's been some regulatory changes at the FDA in terms of trying to standardize and report the race and ethnicity of patients who are enrolled in clinical trials, because prior to that, there was no standardization on that. And then in 2016, the FDA did start publishing their drug snapshots, which gives you a general idea of the patients who are enrolled in these clinical trials. And then what we can talk about in a bit, but just last year, the FDA also published some draft guidance to industry on forming what they call diversity plans, which are plans that sponsors need to have a good understanding of which type of patients in the US have this disease, and then how are you as a sponsor going to actively recruit and ensure that your trial is adequately representing those patients who have that disease in your clinical trial as well. And so with all of those kind of changes in the background, what we wanted to look at was, are these regulatory changes that are being made, are they actually impacting clinical trial reporting as well as enrollment of underserved minorities? And so we looked at those last past 10 years, and we compared the first half of the decade to the second half of the decade. And unfortunately, what we saw is that even though the FDA does, I'd say, a fairly good job on the labels or reporting race and ethnicity, when you look at clinicaltrials.gov, as well as the actual journal manuscripts themselves, they actually do a very poor job of reporting race and ethnicity. Just like I was saying, you either have to go down and find it in the bottom of a supplemental appendix, or a lot of times, and this is especially with ethnicity, it's not even reported. Ethnicity was really only reported in about 30-35% of all the manuscripts that we looked over. On top of that, when we compared the actual enrollment of patients to the proportion of patients in the United States, we found that Black women were only represented at about 31% of what was expected compared to their relative incidence in the US population. White and Hispanic patients were relatively normal, and then Asian patients were very high at 270%. However, the caveat I'll make to that is that the Hispanic patients, it's very hard to generalize because only 30% of those trials reported ethnicity data. And then the Asian patients certainly are represented more compared to the other races and ethnicities. However, that's because a lot of those Asian patients are coming from Japan or China or Korea, because these are large multinational studies. And as an Asian American myself, I've done some research on that. We know that Asians in general are a very heterogeneous group. And so can we apply those findings that are international to Asian Americans like myself here? I don't know if we can. And so I think there's a lot of challenges with generalizing some of these findings. And certainly I recognize that these are multinational trials, but at the end of the day, if the US FDA is making an approval for the US population, then I certainly think it's fair to make that analysis and look at, are we adequately representing the patients that we're giving approvals for?
That's wonderful. I think your work is really great and would encourage everybody to go and read your paper. Since we're discussing FDA, I think one of the things that we notice, and we have Dr. Cole up here, so both to you and Dr. Wen, and you guys can chime in. I think, can you walk us through, it seems like in 2016, the FDA released the guidance to industry detailing the expectations from the sponsors for collecting these really critical data that we need. What is FDA doing now? We've heard a lot of buzz, but just for our listeners, can you detail the efforts the FDA is putting? And I know that we're not seeing much change. Maybe a decade later we'll see it, but we'd like to hear that.
Yeah, certainly. So the latest change was that in last year, the FDA released that draft guidance for industry on forming these diversity plans. I believe that's still just a draft at this time, so I don't believe that those recommendations are finalized. But I will say that having talked to a lot of sponsors about clinical trials, most industry folks and most clinical trial sponsors at this point are trying to get ahead of the curve. I think they've recognized that diversity has been sorely lacking in clinical trials. And so I think most sponsors at this point are starting to integrate diversity plans into their clinical trials. But certainly, I think that's still, since it's a new thing, I think a lot of people are trying to figure out, what does a diversity plan actually mean?
Yeah, that's
mean?
What I was going to ask.
Yeah.
What does it mean? And
what does it mean? Yeah.
Dr. Cole can jump in too, as well, yeah, as to what it means.
Yeah, you know, and just like Dr. Wynn said, I've talked to some of our partners in industry. And really, when you look at those draft recommendations, they have like five major components or scopes. You know, one is, just like Dr. Wynn said, an overview of the disease condition. You know, how many people of an underrepresented racial ethnic population is part of the disease entity that you're studying? The other one is looking at the actual medical device or drug that you're using? And does it have any differences between races with clinical pharmacology? You know, have you done any PK, PD data to show that in every ethnicity or in every race, does your drug have any different toxicity or metabolism? The third one is, what is your goal of enrollment? And I think that's kind of the meat of the draft recommendation, is in the population that you outlined in the first thing, well, how do you plan on enrolling those patients in the clinical trial? And then the fourth one, which is the one I love the most, is how do you plan on retaining those patients? So you're just not going to enroll four Black patients, four Asian patients, then call it a day. Is how are you going to continue your enrollment and continue to retain those patients, and which would include, you know, making sure that you reduce the burdens of being involved in the clinical trial, that not that you go to the community and say, we like a patient on the clinical trial, then leave, but that you have sustained community involvement. And then having the fifth part, and I would suspect that this came from patients, is that you actually give feedback to the community about what they've actually done, to discuss the status of the enrollment goals, and that you say to the community that you went to that here's exactly what you've invested in this clinical trial, people in your community went in the clinical trial, well, here's the output of that. And I think when I've talked to sponsors, they've been really receptive. And just like Dr. Wynn said, they want to stay ahead of the curve. And so they're asking, how can we not only have more diverse populations in our clinical trial, but more importantly, I think, how can you retain those patients in the clinical trial? That they're just not filling out a consent form and then walking away, but how do we sustain that for the long haul?
So yeah, this is all very, very critical in terms of changes and moving the goals forward in terms of disparity research and making sure that all therapeutic drugs that have been FDA approved are relatable to patients and effective for everyone, right? But we find actually that it's not only just therapeutic clinical trials where we have this discrepancy. In fact, even results from screening clinical trials are not relevant to minority populations, such as the National Lung Screening Trial, for instance. And I wonder if you could discuss more about the impact of lung cancer screening, Dr. Wynn.
Of course. Yeah, so I know I've mentioned a lot about breast cancer so far, and I will actually say that I don't treat patients with breast cancer anymore. I primarily take care of patients with lung and melanoma and other skin cancers. But we have a really fantastic lung cancer screening program here at UIC. I have to make a plug for it because we're getting to the end of November, but it is Lung Cancer Awareness Month. And we've been doing a lot of community events this month to try to get folks out and do lung cancer screening. I think it's so important because some data that we've published here at UI Health based on our patient population shows a lot of different numbers compared to that NLST, that National Lung Screening Trial. So in that National Lung Screening Trial, which is probably the most well-cited, one of those pivotal clinical trials that led to the change in the USPSTF recommendations, they only included about 4.5% Black or African-American patients in that. And in that trial, they found that the rate of patients who had a positive cancer diagnosis relative to the screens was about 1.1%. Now, when we've looked at our own data here at UI Health with our patient population, we've actually found that, you know, again, our patient population is about 60% Black or African-American. Our rate of lung cancer diagnosis goes from 1.1 in NLST to about 2.6% here at UI Health using those same screening criteria that have come up at come through NLST. So I think that certainly is a huge difference between those two. That's more than twice the rate. Why those disparities exist, I think there's a lot of more research that we have to do here. But I think it certainly shows that the data that we're getting from these large supposedly pivotal trials that are supposed to represent the United States don't necessarily represent everyone in the United States and certainly don't represent my patients. And so when I see data like that, that's what kind of drives me a little bit crazy in that it makes it hard for me to interpret data at a national level to the patient who's sitting here in front of me. And that's why I'm a huge advocate of lung cancer screening. We do a lot of community events where we just did one this week, and we're going to do one, I think, tomorrow as well, where we're going out to the community, we're telling people about lung cancer screening. And one additional plug I'll make here is that this past year and last year was the first year in the entire history of UIC that we saw more patients with stage 1 to 3 lung cancer compared to stage 4. And so we're actually, and I'll tell you right now, I see more early stage lung cancer than late stage. And I'm very early in my career, but I'll say from what I've heard from a lot of other folks that that is extremely rare, or that's almost unheard of. And I'll say with all the new kind of treatments that are coming out, it's a very different discussion talking about cure in early stage lung cancer compared to talking about just palliation in stage 4.
It's wonderful. I think I'm going to give Dr. Cole some time. I think he has a couple of very burning questions, very important for this topic. So, Dr. Cole.
You know, one, some of the barriers for not enrolling diverse populations in clinical trials are the ones that we build ourselves when we write our clinical trials. And specifically, I know that in myeloma, that one big barrier for enrollment in clinical trials is hematologic parameters for enrollment, and that Black patients have a higher incidence of not being enrolled or enrollment failures because of hematologic parameters, and specifically based on neutrophil counts from the Duffy null status or the neutropenia of ethnicity or benign ethnic neutropenia. And I was wondering your perspective on how we can improve our clinical trial enrollment by looking at that a bit more carefully.
Yeah, that's a great point that you made there. And this is something that we've been discussing actually through the WIN program that I'm a part of. And to their credit, the Vail course that I did a couple of years ago has discussed this as well. There's a really great article that came out by Reiner and colleagues in JCO last year looking at restrictive eligibility criteria. I don't believe that they included Duffy in this one, but I think it gets to the same point that you're making. They looked at all their patients who had pancreatic cancer and came up with, I think, just a standard set of inclusion and exclusion criteria in different clinical trials, and found that on average, all these exclusion criteria like renal function, diabetes, HIV, hepatitis C, these things that, to be honest, I think a lot of folks are just copying and pasting between different protocols. It may not even be an explicit bias, but just by not thinking about it, we're excluding so many patients. And so, you know, you think about that patient, they need to even go to a place that has a clinical trial. And then if they find their way there, then they're not eligible. You know, I've had a few patients that even though they have really well-controlled hepatitis or other different diseases, haven't been able to enroll in a clinical trial. And I think that we as investigators and sponsors need to do a much better job at thinking about these different criteria that are, even if we're not purposely doing it, are actually excluding patients from these clinical trials. So I think looking at that Duffy and counting for that in clinical trial design is certainly important.
And I know in some of the myeloma trials, they're actually doing Duffy phenotyping and actually changing some of the eligibility criteria based on if you're Duffy null or if you have Duffy.
Yeah, and we're starting to look at that here at USC. We don't have like a formal research and protocol for that, but it's certainly something that we've noticed for some of our patients. When I used to do hematology clinic, we would get referrals for these patients who would come in, be told that something was wrong with their blood. And they would be like, what's going on? Am I seeing a cancer doctor? Do I have leukemia? And we'd tell them, no, it's, and even just in the name, right? Benign ethnic neutropenia, it implies that there's something wrong with you because you're ethnic, right? So I think that terminology is no longer, I don't use that terminology.
No.
I always felt bad for patients who would take time off from work because they're typically totally normal, healthy 20, 30 year olds and told that something is wrong with their blood.
I was told to call it the neutrophilia of ethnicity.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
And then I would tell patients, well, it's because, you know, when they made these tests, they were based on essentially 20 to 40 year old white men. So your blood just doesn't look the same as theirs. And a lot of them, when I tell them something like that, they would roll their eyes.
But you're right. I mean, one thing that we do is that when we cut and paste these clinical trials from clinical trials that were very, very restrictive.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to do that, that we, by mistake, absolutely exclude patients from clinical trials. And it's just not, I mean, people with ethnicity from clinical trials. And it's just not neutropenia, but it's also when you look at HIV status and hepatitis status. And actually, the FDA guidance you know, the FDA website on making clinical trials more diverse has a ton of excellent literature to directly to us and how we can make clinical trials, you know, more accessible to everybody. Mm-hmm. But one other barrier that we put up for enrolling diverse populations is area and space. That, you know, a lot of our clinical trials, and definitely, you know, in the Big Ten Cancer Consortia, you know, we're all academic centers. And a lot of people of diverse populations don't have access to an academic center. So how can we decentralize clinical trials? I mean, I've always felt that one of the top things that we should try and do is how can we move clinical trials away from the big academic centers and plop them, you know, directly in the rural areas and in the urban areas where people can have better access to clinical trials.
Yeah, and this is something that we had a great discussion about at the WIN conference that I was at last week. I've been trying to talk with different folks at the IRB, to different sponsors, to different kind of more senior investigators here, because I'd love to try to open up a decentralized trial, especially if we could do through the Big Ten. But I'll tell you, the challenges that I commonly hear from folks is from a regulation standpoint, getting IRBs comfortable with the thought of trying to decentralize a trial can be a little bit wary. And then it comes down to like standard documentation. And then also having, are we as the oncologist at an academic center going to be their oncologist for someone who lives 3 or 4 states away? Or are we partnering with like a local oncologist? And I think so many people get great care in the community. And I think maybe what we need to do is find community sites where we can develop strong partnerships and have kind of an established relationship so that they can get comfortable with the research project and make sure that patients have access to clinical trials. Because I think that's honestly one of the biggest barriers is that we're just not offering clinical trials to enough patients. And that logistical barrier of decentralizing it is a big area. I mean, I'll tell you, if you try to do a clinical trial here in Chicago, for a lot of folks that drive from rural Illinois, Indiana, the number one thing they tell me about is the traffic sucks. Like they have to drive here, which I'll tell you, you know, as someone who used to live in LA, I wouldn't want to plan my life around traffic either. The traffic really sucks. They can just drive down the street and go to the local oncologist. So what's the incentive to do that? And it comes back to my original point about going on the internet. We need to meet people where they're at.
Absolutely.
You can't force people to come to you. And so I think we really have to rethink how we approach clinical trials in the future.
I think you've given us an idea for another topic, right? I think this is such an important topic. I work in central Pennsylvania and we serve a lot of rural Pennsylvanians. And we come across the similar problem should be how to loosen a regulation such that we can capture and deliver treatment closer to their home. So really important topic. And I think we're coming closer to the time limit that we set for ourselves. So I'm going to ask, as usual, I think this is end of the year. So hopefully everybody's in the holiday spirit. And I know we heard a lot from you, Dr. Wen, and we really want to congratulate you on the excellent work that you're doing. And you're such a great asset to Big Ten Cancer Research Consortium. So thank you for coming on our show and having this fantastic discussion. I also want to thank Dr. Cole and Dr. Mene. What a wonderful, wonderful co-chairs they are. And thank you for joining in the conversation. And I want to thank all our listeners on behalf of the Big Ten Cancer Research Consortium for spending time with us and hope you have a Merry Christmas and a very Happy New Year.
Happy holidays, everyone.
Happy New Year.